You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
My name's Sam. I'm one of the hosts here at Hot House. I'm delighted to welcome you to Love, Fear and Action with members of the RSPB Youth Council. Any RSPB members in? One, two, three. Three. So lots of recruitment to do. I'm going to introduce you to our speakers in a moment, but first to say Hot House is generously sponsored by the Pickwell Foundation, who have provided the decoration and theme for Hot House today. Pickwell Foundation have worked with Greenbelt for many years, and they sponsor projects and people who are committed to action on climate and on displacement and migration. And there are lots of things about the Pickwell Foundation around here, as well as members you can talk to. I'm going to introduce you now to our three speakers. They are, in no particular order, Senan and Kay and Freddie. They are three members of the RSPB Youth Council. RSPB is still, we think, the largest environmental and conservation group in Europe. And so they're an important part of the RSPB's commitment to work with younger people to engage in action on climate change. They're going to share with you now their part of their journey into activism and involvement with the RSPB, and then we will have a Q&A where you can ask them questions afterwards. I'll hand over to Senan.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all so much for coming and welcome. It's really nice to be here today. As we said, we are the RSPB Youth Council, and it's especially nice to be here today because when we were having our discussions in preparation for this talk, we have a very kind of broad range of Greenbelt experience on the panel here today, which is really lovely. I know, Kay, it's your 15th Greenbelt this year, so you're kind of the old master of Greenbelt. Senan, it's your first time here ever, so you're going to be, we're going to be converting you into a seasoned Greenbelter by the end. It's my second time as well, after having come last year on brilliant recommendation of Kay and my friend Caitlin over in the audience as well. But it's such a lovely space as well, and we're really happy to be able to be here speaking today as well to you all. So before we say a little bit more about kind of who we are and what we do with the RSPB Youth Council, should we go down and do some quick introductions, kind of name, pronouns, who we are, and like our ages, stage of life as well. So my name's Freddie, I'm 20, he, him, and I'm a languages student at the moment, just finished my second year of university, and doing lots of things alongside it with the RSPB and organisations like Teach the Future as well.
Hello, I'm Kay. Apologies for my voice. I've lost it, so I sound like a teenage boy. I'm very sorry. My name's Kay, Kay Wren. I use they, them pronouns. I'm 18, and I've just finished my A-levels, and I'm going on to do a gap year.
Nice. And I'm Senan. I'm 22, pronouns she, her. And I've just finished studying photography, and I'm in the crazy post-uni period, and I've become a barista out of panic. So that's currently where I'm at.
Yeah. Cool. So yeah, as I said, we're here today to talk a little bit about our journeys into activism, because one of the things that links us all, like, we are all kind of obviously in a similar place now. We're all working with the RSPB Youth Council and doing lots of work with them. But I think we've all come from very different pathways into this space. And so I think that's something that we'd like to delve into a little bit more, because I think that's something that's really interesting to consider in terms of the different ways in which people get involved with activism and the different kind of motivators and things that can inspire us to kind of, yeah, take action for the things and the places that we love. Hence Love, Fear and Action. And also a little bit about kind of our experiences, I guess, bringing a youth voice into the conservation and the environmental sector too. So we'd like to start off with a bit of storytelling, really, because I think Kay and I both run a storytelling podcast as well called Generation Nature, and we're very passionate about the power of stories and kind of in being able to convey information in a way that that facts and figures often can't. So I think they're one of the most powerful tools we have, really, in terms of being able to engage with others. So in that vein, we're going to start off telling our stories about our kind of our journeys and how we started to get into activism. Senna, would you like to?
Yeah, for sure. So I've lived in London my whole life, which is not very green. And when I was like 10, I was looking through an Argos catalogue, classic nature upbringing story. And I saw this book on birdsong and I was like, wow, I don't know anything about that. I would love that for Christmas. And then got this book and was looking in my garden one day and saw this like brown bird, and I didn't know what it was, and I was like looking through the book to see what it was, and it was a dunnock. I don't know if people know what that is, but just like a brown streaky bird that looks a bit like a robin. And it was just crazy to me how like there was this whole layer of reality that like existed outside of like my current life, and the like joy of like uncovering that and like looking for those things and realizing the world is like so full of like these organisms that have just like lived here alongside me my whole life. Is really what got me into like nature. And then my grandma actually got me a membership for the RSPB, because we all know it's like quite a older person heavier organization, and that was a great thing, because that was a wonderful community to become part of, because then I then joined the youth council. And then later on I also got involved with some activism with Extinction Rebellion as well, and that was like realizing that the love kind of like had a responsibility to it, and like I realized I wanted to do activism, do like advocacy and charities and stuff, because that was a way of like channeling the love into like into action. So yeah. But what about you, Kay? Go to Freddie first.
Yeah, go. I am happy to. I think my journey in many ways is like similar to yours in terms of the kind of that founding emotion that kind of kicked it off. I think for me it was also very much that love, that sense of love. I think I've kind of always spent a childhood growing up outdoors. I live in the Chilterns, and always kind of when I was younger had dogs, so we would take the dogs out on our daily dog walks into the beach woodlands and chalk grasslands of the Chilterns
Our dogs were like one of the reasons I was like we went on walks and I saw stuff on walks.
It does seem to be such a catalyst for getting outdoors at a younger age. And yeah, I think that was really it for me. It was that kind of early immersion in nature from a really young age that really kick-founded that passion, because I often like hear the quote by David Attenborough that no one will protect what they don't love, and no one will love what they've never experienced. And I think it's so true. I think you have to, that early immersion is a really powerful kind of force in terms of catalyzing that kind of joy and love and wanting to take action. I also had an allotment when I was growing up, and for me that was a wonderful way of kind of engaging with nature. I don't know if anyone's seen the film Bridge to Terabithia, but I always thought that the allotment was kind of my Terabithia, that this kind of idea of like a wonderful, magical place that was just there for you to kind of roam around. And it was really, that was, I think, also really quite formative for me as a child, having that space, to engage with. Having said that, I do think it was something an interest I was quite kind of isolated in for a long time, until I started, my mum kind of saw in a local newsletter a programme called Chilterns News Shoots, which was essentially a year-long programme for young people to learn about kind of species identification and conservation techniques. And that for me was a really kind of pivotal moment in realising that actually this is not something that I'm just isolated in, and actually there are so many other people and young people out there that also care about environmental issues. And I think that's such a powerful thing in terms of being able to find that community, and also kind of realizing that actually this is a tangible career path that I could follow as well. It was kind of off the back of that that I think grew massively in confidence, and then applied to join the RSPB Youth Council as well when I saw that. The advert kind of come up, and yeah, since then it's been amazing, like met so many kind of fantastic people, like really really close friends through this work, and got involved in so many incredible projects as well, all founded really from that early immersion in nature as a child. So I'm incredibly grateful I had that. And yeah, really glad that it's led me to the place that we're all at today. But I know that Kay, you had a slightly different experience growing up in terms of, yeah, the kind of emotions and that those motivating factors for you.
Yes, so my story's a bit different. These two came to love of nature through curiosity and love to begin with. Mine came through a very stark fear and extreme anxiety towards the climate crisis and destruction of nature and everything. A bit like Freddie, I had quite an outdoorsy childhood. My parents very fortunate enough to take me out walking quite a lot. I don't think I appreciated it at the time, but sorry. But it definitely helped. I came into this through fear, which then developed into love. And that was first sparked probably at Greenbelt 4 years ago. Don't know if you remember, but it was the wake up year and we had the communion, which was like based on the climate crisis. And it was, what is Greenbelt going to be like in 2052? And I was 14 at the time. And that's the first time I'd ever really considered the future at all. And I just remember being so scared, like, am I going to grow up in a world that's burning? And the answer to that now is yes, I am. Is yes, I am. But then I had never thought about it. And it just filled me with so much fear. And I was like, what on earth do I do with this emotion? I've never been so scared of something before. So I had this idea that, oh, I'm going to like do poetry and I'm going to get my friends to do art and we're going to do it on social media and become famous. And then after Greenbelt, that passion kind of died for a bit. But then the fear was sparked again in January of year 10, where it was a throwaway comment from my dad started making me think about the future again and how my life would look affected by the climate crisis. And I started researching what the predicted effects would be, like what's the world going to be like in 2050? What's it going to be like in 2030? And obviously even now, this summer kind of seems dystopian to what it was like 5 years ago. And that just filled me with so much dread that it honestly kind of paralyzed me. I've got a couple of memories of I was just kind of lying in my bed crying because I was so scared and I couldn't really move because I was just like, it's going to be awful. We're all going to die. Help. I don't know what to do. And then what was a really big catalyst moment was I started doing work experience at my local nature reserve. And that really helped alleviate quite a lot of this climate anxiety, which is what we call it. And that, A, got me outside, which is obviously good for mental health anyway. But it also made me realise, oh, I can do work at a local level and I can make a difference. Because lying in bed worrying about this isn't going to change the world at all. So then I did work experience at my local nature reserve in York called St Nick's. And I'm still there now, and that kind of really helped me develop my love of nature, and I started teaching myself plants and things. And then it was from the fear that turned to action, which then turned to love. And like Senan said, before I was just living my life, but there was this whole other world beneath the surface, like the changing seasons and the migration of birds and the turning of flowers that I had no idea of. And now I can see and appreciate every day. And then I also got involved in Extinction Rebellion and Christian Climate Action and stuff, and got quite a lot involved in protests and stuff. But it was that initial fear at Greenbelt and then from just research and stuff that made me terrified, but then St. Nick's brought it to love, really, which has never gone away, like four years later.
Yeah. And I think your journey is very important because we're all, what I do anyway, move into fear, out of fear, into being paralyzed, out of being paralyzed. And that's just like kind of the way it is. If you're in love with nature and you see what's happening, of course you're going to be sad and scared because it's horrifying. But I think I don't like regret it in any way, and it is life-giving in such a way, you know what I mean? And the fear like eventually does lead you to like communities like the youth council and things like that. And what we'll talk about now is like where our journeys have led us to our current, like where we are currently off the back of these like emotional experiences. Freddie, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I can do. So yeah, I think, yeah, as you say, those kind of emotions I think the differences in the emotions show that it's so important not to take that kind of singular approach to engaging with people about the climate and nature crises, because there's no one kind of method that will work for everyone. Some people, it is that kind of the hearing the starkness of the science that motivates them, but others it's the hope and getting involved and actually finding brilliant things to get involved with. And I think because of that, you can't just kind of, and it's not passive hope either. It's a sense of, it's really active hope. I always love the metaphor that, you know, hope is not a kind of distant winged angel. It's hope is something that, you know, they get down on their knees and they get their hands and knees dirty and they're taking action. Hope is something you have to work at and work really hard, to achieve and to maintain as well. And I think, it's in that vein, kind of with hope in mind, lots of kind of thinking about where those journeys have led us and what we do now, how we kind of use our individual skills to make a difference and inspire others. For me, it's very much, I mean, it's kind of linked with, I mentioned earlier, I'm a language student, I study languages, and I'm really interested in kind of the ways in which we can use writing and words and storytelling to kind of communicate and engage people and really kind of capture hearts and minds about the climate and nature crises, because I mentioned earlier, I think that's one of the most powerful ways of reaching people. I think, you know, language itself is kind of integral to the way in which we perceive the world. Different languages with different kind of words for particular things can have incredibly different concepts of those particular things, and the words we use are such a kind of important factor in determining how we perceive them. So, for example, there's lots of indigenous languages that use the same pronouns to refer to things in nature as they would to refer to their own family, and I think that's really lovely because it just shows that kind of inherent connection that many cultures, especially indigenous cultures, have with the natural world and how they kind of naturally perceive themselves to be a part of nature through their language and their culture. And again, it shows kind of how distanced in many ways that we in the Western world have become from nature. That shows in our language, where we ostracize parts of the natural world as weeds or pests, when actually they're just, why do we call them that? They're just kind of, it's contextual. It's why they're in a particular scenario where we would consider them as weeds and pests, but actually they're just, you know, a part of the whole natural ecosystem. And things like natural resources or fish stocks, the way in which we talk about nature is often so kind of in terms of either the direct gain or detriment that it poses to us as a species. And that this is a really kind of binary way of looking at nature, I think. And it's whereas in reality, we are all such an integral part of nature. And I think we there are so many ways in which we can kind of change the language we use and talk about nature in a way that's much more kind of vibrant and living and appreciates our part within it. So that's something I'm really interested in, and really interested in how we can use language to re-examine our relationship with the natural world. I think that's incredibly important. And that's the kind of, I guess, my kind of like niche, like interdisciplinary approach that I kind of bring to my kind of climate nature activism. And I think that's an important point in itself, because there's such value in those kind of interdisciplinary approaches. I think so often in the sector we hear about the only pathway really into conservation is studying like ecology at university or something along those lines, or biology. And I think actually there's so much more that we need. We need people of kind of all skill sets and all different backgrounds and interests learning about and contributing their skills to the environment crisis, because, you know, these are some of the most intersectional and interdisciplinary crises of our time. So it's how can we harness the massive kind of diverse range of skill sets present even here, I'm sure, in the audience, and how can we kind of use them all to contribute towards the climate crisis? In that vein, I also work with an organization called Teach the Future, which is all about how we can integrate climate and nature into subjects across the school curriculum. Is exactly kind of in that aim of encouraging young people to think about these crises from an intersectional point of view, and to think about how English or math or science or geography can contribute to making a difference to the climate crisis. And yeah, I think that that's so important that we kind of really get that message across from a young age that these are issues that we need everyone to come together and to rally behind, no matter what their individual backgrounds and experience.
Yeah. A quick anecdote is that conservation charities are desperate for people who are like into birds, but then also like if you're an aspiring finance bro and you like birds, they need you. Like they have people who do their finances, their fundraising, their admin and stuff, and it's like, so they really, really need people who are interdisciplinary. But yeah.
As I know you, Senan, you're very interested in different creative ways of engaging with nature.
Yeah, me and Freddie are quite similar, and like we've gone down quite a creative, like cultural route with our activism and like lives. So I studied photography, and then studied past tense, and then I'm an artist, and I think it's really important to like be able to communicate to people like how amazing nature feels to be in, and then also like what we need to be doing. But then also the communication is really hard because there's just really like science, which is so scary, but then also like great hopeful stories and things like this. And I think I'm still figuring out how to do that. And because I grew up in an urban area, I've kind of hit on like a very niche thing, which is like mixing sci-fi and birds, which is really weird. But like, I think the experience of living in an urban area requires like its own like storytelling. And also like, there's also like, I feel so angry sometimes and like so worried. And my way of like coping with that is drawing birds, like eating warplanes and like, I don't know, like doing like this, like taking over the Houses of Parliament. And I think that like art is like an emotional way to like get your emotions out about how you're feeling about the state of the world, a way to like express your love for nature and hopefully pass that on to other people. And then also a way to like communicate with people on serious topics in a way that is like palatable, like that can be taken in. But as well as like art, I'm involved with the Youth Council, and I think it's important like to change culture, but also like to try and like go through a governance route. And we'll talk about this in a bit, like to try and change like organizations and stuff like that, which is very different from the birds eating the government. But
You have, absolutely have to check out Senan's Curlew characters. They're incredible.
Love Curlew. Thank you very much. Yeah, Curlew is my favorite bird. They're like a wading bird. Really? Yeah. We're going to talk afterwards.
Yeah.
Have a Curlew dram.
I'm just your bog standard ecology student, really.
Oh, okay,
We've got artist and linguist. I still volunteer with my local nature reserve, go birding, etc. In my gap year, I've got a job lined up with the Methodist Church, which is trying to link people, faith, and nature. Not entirely sure what it's going to look like yet, but hopefully it's going to be helping churches like make their grounds more wild. And what I really want to do is like run bushcraft sessions for toddlers. Again, not sure if it's going to be able to happen, but that is something I'm definitely looking into. But after that, I'm going to uni to study ecology, and I want to be a wildlife ranger, and I'm still doing activism.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
But you picked a lot of people in the nature sector, you'd pick someone like me, who's quite a lot of us study ecology, so these two guys are quite unique.
We're rogue.
But that in itself is a kind of interdisciplinary way of thinking about it. You in terms of your faith, like you kind of bring nature and your faith together a lot, I know, and that's kind of one of the ways in which you approach.
Yes, I'd forgotten that. I was meant to talk about that. I forgot. Yeah. Hello, I'm a Christian. Yeah, work with them. So I find that my faith and nature link heavily. Every time I go for a walk, I find God there. I try and say Celtic daily prayer from the Northumbria community. Yeah, I try and say that daily and normally when I'm out in nature. And there's, and then also there's a charity called Arusha who like link nature and the faith, and that I'm going to live with the North Norwich community for a bit next week, and hopefully I can work with them on making it a bit more wild. But yeah, that's kind of me, faith, nature, ecology. But there's this lovely quote by someone who I can't remember, but it's like, it says something like, all the world is alive with God and like on fire with it, but only those who take off their shoes can recognize it. So it's only those who realize they're standing on a holy ground, and the rest just sit around and eat blackberries, is what the quote says. But that definitely sums up my link between faith and nature, I think. Sorry, my voice is gone.
Yeah, and I think that's really lovely. I think that we all have these kind of different ways of engaging with activism, even now with kind of this combined group that we're all part of. So I guess let's talk a little bit more about that then, because that is, I suppose, the intersection of all of our interests is the RSPB Youth Council. That is kind of where our activism collides. And actually, as a side note, I think activism itself is a really interesting word, because I think activism, if you kind of look at the etymology of it, kind of again going back to my interest in languages, is it like at its roots, it means, you know, kind of acting on earth, taking action. And so I think in a way I would say that all of us are activists, all of us on our earth, this earth, can are activists, because we are all people who are active on the planet. It's just a matter of kind of where we choose to direct those actions and where we choose to kind of what path we choose to follow. So in terms of the path that we've chosen to follow that have collided within the RSPB Youth Council. So should we say a little bit more about the Youth Council ourselves and who we are and what we do within the organisation?
Yeah, so it's quite old. I don't know how many years old it is, actually. 20 plus 20 years old. But recently took a really, like, has become quite integrated in the charity. So we do a lot of different things. We, like, help with their campaigning. We, like, do very specific things, like engage with young farmers, like people in our Youth Council interested in farming. We have done other events. We've spoken at the Tate about art and nature. We write for their magazine. We advise them on how we think they could best engage young people, you know, try and get them to like do more stuff on social media, etc. And also we'll talk about, we do governance stuff, which is basically just like how decisions get made in the charity. We're involved with that as well. But yeah, any other summary points of it?
Yeah, no, I think that's it. Well, yeah. It's all really about bringing that youth voice to the organisation, yeah, and to kind of making sure that that's integrated in everything that they do. Because I think as young people, again, we'll touch on this, but kind of bringing those new perspectives and kind of challenging the status quo and helping to kind of almost future-proof the organisation so that they are, kind of remaining somewhere that young people want to go and somewhere that young people want to engage with, that's kind of, yeah, relevant to their lives. And I think that's a key part of our role. That manifests itself like very much within kind of governance, which you mentioned, Senna. So we all kind of independently sit, in addition to our roles on the Youth Council, sit on internal governance committees. Kay, you sit on the conservation committee, which I think you enjoy slightly more now, having been moved from the finance committee, which you were not enjoying as much. and I sit on the communications and engagement advisory committee, which is, if anyone who has worked in kind of charities before will know that charities love an incredibly long name and an acronym. It's, yeah, part and parcel of being involved in this space. And Senan, as of recently, holds a very important role, which is you are an observer to the Board of Trustees, which is amazing. It's a really big success that we've had over the last few years, especially in terms of kind of being able to now have you as that point of contact who can kind of raise our perspectives directly with the trustees and ensure that kind of, yeah, long-term sustainability and getting our ideas across, making sure they're integrated more widely. So would you like to talk a little bit about that and kind of how you've found it, lessons you've learned, that kind of thing?
And if anyone doesn't know, trustees are like, the top of the organization is the CEO and their leadership team. And then the trustees are unpaid, like, advisors who tell the charity, like, yes, you're doing the correct thing. No, you're doing the wrong thing. So they kind of hold the same power as, like, CEO level, but they're not paid. Great. Barista life forever. So, yeah, I think it's so important to have young people in, like, higher positions of power in organizations, because for, like, multiple reasons. But you get kind of, like, people get institutionalized, which, like, they kind of get told you can only do things a certain way, and so they kind of only do things a certain way. But as a young person, lots of people are worried they don't have the correct experience to do. You do. You have lived experience. And the fact that you aren't seeing through this red tape is amazing, because then you'll be able to kind of say things unfiltered that probably people in that room would like to say, don't know whether they're allowed to say it, but you kind of have the card of, like, oh, they're a young person, they can say what they want. So you kind of do that for them. And so that's super important, to just be like, you can just be super frank about, like, what's going on, and just cut through, like, acronyms. There's so many freaking acronyms.
Has that happened to you on the trustee board?
Ooh, good question. What would be a good example of that? Like, yeah, they were kind of, what were they talking about recently? Like, oh, like when there are discussions about how to use social media and stuff, it's like, oh, how are we going to get more engagement and, like, membership and do-do-do-do-do, and, like, what's the revenue and the holdovers on this? I don't know what those words mean. But like, it's like, I would just say, look, young people on social media is ultimately, I think, bad for people. So you want to have a channel for them to come out of social media. That's ultimately what you want from social media. You also have a ton of, like, anxiety generated on social media. You need to be very careful about what you do with that. And you also have a responsibility as an organization with so much knowledge to be making content that, you know, will reach young people, rather than, because the RSPB is an old organization. They have a very set way of doing things. And I think they're like, oh, if we don't post this picture of a puffin without a meme, then no one's going to like, no, just post a picture of a puffin with the meme, because the young people will come to that. And, but yeah, they're kind of maybe more like confidential examples. I can't share. But what else about being on the trustee board?
Any kind of, I don't know, like, challenges that you've faced, or yeah, how have you found it kind of interacting with the different generations that are represented on the board, and kind of acting as in your role as a kind of ambassador for young people to try and reach more young people?
Yeah, I think like with Kay's kind of awakening into the climate crisis, is like, we're thinking about a future still, like, young people, we're thinking about future, we don't really know what our lives are like, they're very uncertain at the minute maybe. And whereas these people are all, I would say, over the age of, like, a lot of them are retired, because that's what gives them free time to be on a trustee board. And they kind of have this weird complacency that, like, but it's all going to work out. Like, it's going to be fine. You know, like, the Cold War was fine. The financial crisis resolved itself. It's all going to be fine. And so I think there's, like, again, anger. Anger is, like, a current emotion that I have, and I think it's a very important emotion. Like, anger and fear is something I have, that I try and remind them of, that, like, no, it's not going to be okay. You have to be really serious about this and really think about, like, pushing, like, these people. They have a lot of power, a lot of inside track with government at the RSPB. Like, you have to take that really seriously and really push that. And I find myself a lot being the only person in the room who's, like, pushing the, like, no, people are really worried about this. Or, like, I hear people saying, oh, don't worry, because, like, oh, robots will be looking after us when we're old. I'm like, no, because there are people now being impacted by it, young people being impacted by it, working class people being impacted by it.
We've seen it this summer with the extreme heat and the kind of inequalities in that, in terms of, you know, the people who were able to afford sitting in air-conditioned rooms, absolutely, versus the people who are confined to high-rise council flats and having to endure these periods of extreme heat in there. You know, the climate crisis is always a social crisis as well, first and foremost, and there's massive inequalities associated with that.
It's just because it's not affecting you doesn't mean it's not affecting everyone.
Exactly, and you just have to kind of, like, remind them of that, or, like, Yeah, the air conditioning one is interesting. It's almost like people talk about people going into their doomsday bunkers, don't they? And like, if you have air conditioning, you're effectively in a kind of bunker already of safety. And because young people don't necessarily have that security yet, it's so important because we look out for each other and we're like telling people in power, no, you have to really do something about this. You have to stop giving the fossil fuel people money, hence the no oil patch. But yeah, that's the trustee board.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, I mean, that shows like the power of and the importance of intergenerational collaboration in this space. I think it is just the most important way forward because we need to, you know, none of us have all of the answers to these issues, but by working together, by kind of bringing that combined wisdom and knowledge and different kind of life experiences, that's the way in which we're going to actually get through this crisis and kind of learn from each other and be able to make a difference. So I guess, but before we come to the audience for questions, then what is it that is so important about that kind of collaboration from our side? What is it that I guess we as young people bring to the table, and why does that work so well with the other generations? Experiences as well.
I would say what's great about young people is we refuse to take no for an answer.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
I myself am very stubborn, as my family will know. You don't need to nod your head. But I think, like Sen said, we literally just don't see the red tape. Because, yes, we don't have the experiences that, like, all the retired people have. Like, I've never had a job interview. I've never had a salary, though I will soon. I've never had to pay taxes. And that does come from a place of privilege that I've been able to get through my life without having a job so far. And I've not been to uni yet. Like, there's so much stuff in my life I've never done. But also, when I'm in an organisation, it's not just the RSPB, but they're trying to make decisions. And they're like, oh, well, there's this thing which is stopping us. And there's this thing which is stopping us. And I'm just like, why? Why is that stopping you? I can think of a way around it. Mm. You just do this, that, and the other. And then they're like, no, we can't do it because of this. Mm. And then you get shut down because you're young and you're inexperienced and you're being too rash and you're not thinking properly. But I think it's that drive and passion of being young and being hopeful and being like constantly optimistic that I am looking forward to the future, even though it does look a bit awful right now. But we're taking questions later. But thanks. But the drive of young people and the energy we bring to a room, I think, is definitely something that why we need intergenerational work, because just sometimes being in a meeting or volunteering when I'm the youngest person by 50 years, it's just a bit like these guys just seem to have kind of given up a bit on hope. And they might have forgotten, like, what hope is, and they're doing the good work, but they've just kind of accepted that it's not really going to change much, and this is just what, like, the future's going to be awful anyway, and we may as well do our bit. But again, there's no real point. But the whole thing of taking action is having living hope, and I think that is a lot what young people can bring to a room, just energy and optimism.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point, because I think a lot of older people are also lamenting, like, they think that young people only want to be online. They think they don't really care about nature. They don't really interact with it very much. And being able to, like, bring passion to an older person, being like, oh, so, like, do you want to talk about curlew? Like, what do you know about curlew? They want to like, share things with you. The people who I speak to are so knowledgeable. And this knowledge isn't really, like, valued in society so much, but, like, that know so much about where birds breed or, like, how they migrate and, like, how to look after them. They're so happy when you come to them, like, oh, I'm really interested in this. And they're like, amazing, let me show you this nest of a reed warbler. That's like, I want to nerd out with somebody. Like, so I think that's also a really nice interaction with the older generation. I've definitely found that I've really, like, that's been awesome.
It really is. And that's, I think that's also why just spaces are so important for us to come together, in spaces like this as well. Spaces where different generations come together, interact, have those conversations, sometimes difficult conversations about how we can kind of work together and move forward and towards a better future. So with that in mind, we'd really like to open up the floor to questions and to discussions if anyone has any questions that they'd like to start with to kick us off.
Just be aware that this microphone is attached still, so I can only come so far. So if you're out there and want to, then if you kind of meet somewhere in the middle, that would be excellent. I'll start. If you want to say your name and then your question. Thanks.
I'll gag. I'm Bethany. You've talked a lot about kind of how art and culture can play into nature activism. And sometimes I worry that when we're talking about the climate crisis, then there's a bit of a sense that humans have only done bad for nature. Like before humans, everything was fine. We should just try and eliminate everything to do with humans, which obviously is not really the... No one actually wants that. But how can we think about how humans have done good things for nature and how things that are human-made we should also love, as well as loving nature and intertwining those things?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's such an important point. I think there is so much, not unintentionally, but possibly, but there's so much kind of misanthropy within the conservation sector. Often we see humans as, you know, this destructing force. You could, like, don't walk through this field because you might trample the curlew nest, or you know, people letting dogs off the leads, and they're so kind of demonized often. And I suppose in some ways, yes, that we need more education in kind of encouraging people to be more careful in those kinds of ways. But also, I think there are so many kind of systematic issues that make it that kind of make it difficult to stay away from that idea. And I think I would recommend massively a book by Lucy Lapwing that's just come out. She's a RSPB ambassador and a wonderful kind of advocate for nature. And she talks a lot about this in her book Love Is a Toad, a lot about kind of this idea of how actually humans are not bad for the planet. She says humans are one of her favorite species because we are as much a kind of part of this web as any other species, and I don't think we as humans are inherently bad for the planet at all. I think it's much more complex and much more kind of systematic than that, the issues at play.
And if you want to, like, have hope restored in humanity, I would just say just go for a walk in your local community. What brings me hope the most is volunteering at my local nature reserve and going to, like, really local events and just seeing members of the public engaging with nature and, like, planting seeds and planting trees and just sitting on the grass experiencing something. And there's definitely a media narrative that all the bad things, that's only what's shown. But if you look at, like, a very, very local level, there's loads of community groups, there's food banks, there's the soup kitchens, there's nature reserves, there's, like, so much good going on, but it's never noticed. And that's always what restores my hope in humanity. It's just a shame that all the big people seem to be the bad people.
I'll just also add on to that, sorry, briefly, is that, like, on your last point, it's not humanity. It's, like, five companies. Do you know what I mean? Like, it is, yes, we've kind of entered ourselves into a system which is destructive ultimately, but it really is people who've accumulated power, and which is why I think we sometimes feel so, like hopeless, is because there are these centers of power which have kind of doing majority of the destructive force, which is almost great because that means that the majority of us don't want that. Like, how many people in this room work for, like, Shell? No one. Great. So we are so like, we all want to do the same thing. I also think in a more poetic way, like, nature, like, does use the things that we make and wants to constantly, like, be interacting with us and a part of us. There are, like, there's a bird called a bower bird. It's not English. And it, like, lays out colourful things for its partner to show off to its partner, like, it will collect, like, colourful pink things to display in front of. And increasingly, they've been collecting, like, plastic forks, which is bad. But it also says that, like, nature doesn't distinguish between what is artificial and what is not. Like, whatever humanity creates, it will, like, take back into itself, which gives us, A, the responsibility to make stuff that is not damaging to nature, but also means that whenever we're ready, like, it's going to be, like, cool, like, I'll use what you make and I'll give you back. So, which I think is, that's my poetic take, but yeah.
Okay, I am the daughter of somebody who was Shell's major planner in charge of planning. I actually wrote a book about traffic reduction. And my parents divorced when I was five, so I didn't live a lot with my dad. But there's $104 billion, billion barrels a day of oil, a current demand, and he predicts it going to 120 billion barrels a day. And he says that what we need to tackle is the demand for oil, i.e. traffic reduction, fundamentally, because oil is powering motor vehicles, oil and diesel and gas and so on, are powering motor vehicles more than anything else. So what's the RSPB and your take on traffic reduction, and is what does the RSPB do for that? Because I think that really is the way forward. The Department for Transport don't tackle traffic reduction, and they haven't even really supported speed reduction massively. I used to be the campaign manager for 20's Plenty. When you talk to a politician, they go, oh, I'm really in favour of public transport, but they don't go into motor normativity.
I would say we are not qualified to answer that. And the RSPB, we don't know how they would answer that. And yes, the demand supply thing is complicated. I think people, basically, this is a conversation for another time. But I think that the solar industry could be invested in way more. The RSPB does do stuff about the solar industry and trying to open up land of places where nature and solar power can like be good for each other, because it is solar uses up a lot of land, will use up a lot of land. So that's what the RSPB is doing to try and aid the transition going forward. But
I think that's the most important thing, is that the just transition. We need it to be a transition that works for both people and nature. And I think that has to be at the core, that we're always kind of considering the effects on people and on the natural world as well, and working towards a future where, you know, housing, transport, nature, infrastructure all kind of work together in harmony and don't kind of oppose each other or come into conflict with each other. I think that's the kind of key principle.
Hi, I'm Thomas. I was just thinking, you've talked about kind of how there are like these big companies that cause a lot of the problems. What kind of can we do in particular to kind of help challenge those companies and challenge that power and try and make change that way? Like, what would you say is the best way to do that?
Boycott them. Is one. That's not always a viable option, because the alternative, like ethical stuff, is really expensive, especially in a cost of living crisis. If you don't buy from them, then they don't get your money. Then that makes it quite clear to them that, like, if enough people do it, it makes it clear that they don't want this. Anything else?
I think it's like important to look for ways in which you can make your voice heard as well in other ways. I think raising awareness, like there are so many kind of public platforms that can help you to raise awareness. And I think that, you know, we want to, you know, we I think again there's an issue with like seeing people as just completely the enemy and not trying to kind of engage with their points of view. And I think that it's very difficult a lot of the time, but I think also there are ways in which we can kind of try and come together and try and understand what other people are coming from and kind of work towards a way. I think we've learned that so much with the RSPB in terms of like being able to bring our youth voice into that organisation. I think we need more avenues like that where kind of young people can be empowered to kind of share their thoughts and share their opinions be able to kind of contribute towards these decisions that are defining our futures, essentially.
Yeah, and I think activism is important, but I think it's complicated how much change like you can get from that when you're coming up against very powerful forces. But again, I would go back to my point about like the majority of people want the same thing in the end. And just like community, again, I think is very important, and coming together for like specific things, I think will ultimately kind of the old way will die out, maybe, or like as in it will I don't know how to describe it, like, yeah, I don't know, I think we just all have the same priorities at the end. Basically, it's complicated and I would say more controversial stuff, but I'll talk to you afterwards.
It's really interesting hearing all your stories of like coming to activism and finding other people who are really passionate about nature. I guess I'm interested in how to engage people who aren't that passionate about nature, and like trying to talk to friends or people you know whether it's like other young people or older people who just like don't care that much about nature, and trying to have these conversations but not wanting to be like a nagging voice where I'm just like, remember, the world is dying, because I feel like it can annoy people and then you don't want to have those conversations, but it feels bad to just like give up on it. So I'm just wondering about advice on engaging people who aren't that interested in it.
What I've done with my friends is get to them through humour. There's a bird called a great tit. And every time I see one, I always point it out. And I've got one friend in particular who can't stop laughing every time I say it. And because of that, they all know how to ID great tits. And my hope is that they will then be more aware of the birds around them because they know that there's a bird called a great tit, there's a bird called a bearded tit, there's a bird called a shag. And I basically tell them all the funny ones so then they're more aware of what's around them. That's what I've done.
I think a huge part of it too is about meeting people where they're at and kind of like using, again, it comes back to like those interdisciplinary interests. How can we kind of make those links towards different people's interests and kind of and think about, okay, what kind of you're interested in and how might that overlap with nature? How might that impact and be impacted by the climate crisis? Because I think as like these are some incredibly kind of wide-reaching and intersectional issues, and I think that they overlap so much with different all areas of our life. Nature, you know, underpins everything that we are. It's the food we eat, it's the air we breathe, and it's the water we drink. And you'd be hard pressed to find anything really that would not, any kind of discipline or sector or interest that would not be affected by it. And so I think it's really about, yeah, you kind of using those interdisciplinary and intersectional interests and yeah, meeting people where they're at in terms of, making those links and making sure that we're considering it from these issues from a much more wider, holistic and kind of systems level, perspective.
Yeah, and with like the humour, and my love for curlew, one of the ways I engage some of my friends is I made like a little cartoon character of this bird and like, it'd be like curlew's like making toast, or like curlew's on a swing, or like curlew's going through an interdimensional portal. I don't know, like my sci-fi stuff creeping in. But people generically, I think, just like birds and being in green spaces, and that's kind of like, I think for my friends, I haven't like tried to push them into like, you must, I like, memorize this field guide. It's like, they're like, oh, let's just go to a park. Or you like being in a green space. Do you want to know about how to protect this green space? And I think, what's it called? Biophilia? Like, everybody's drawn to and is joyous, like, in natural green spaces. And people value it so much. So I think that's important. And even, like, with my interest in sci-fi, people are very, like, into, like, I was talking about us going to Comic-Con, like, maybe could we engage that kind of audience in some way, talking about this crazy, like, essentially like sci-fi story that is nature, in my opinion. Like, it's mental stuff has happening, like birds eating bone marrow and stuff, like, it's crazy stuff. But everyone I think is ultimately interested. It just depends what they do with that.
Any more?
Oh, great.
Hi, I'm Jess. I'm going to university this year, and I'm just wondering about what are the biggest steps you can take to become more involved with a completely new community when you're moving to a new place, and how can I become involved in sort of climate activism there when I have no, you know, previous experience in that location?
I think partly it's about putting yourself out there, putting yourself into kind of new situations. I think universities are an amazing place to kind of get started because there are so many societies and so many different interest groups that you can join. And I think that's a really powerful way, because I think that's in all three of our stories, I think one of the points that we have in common is about that kind of community that we've started to find and how really our kind of action and passion has grown from there. So I think that's, yeah, really one of the most powerful things you can do is to join interest groups to kind of seek out all of the different opportunities in your local area. There are so many local groups around the country. RSPB have lots of local groups, but also so many other organisations do as well. And I think, yeah, it's about finding your people and not being afraid to kind of go out there and seek them out, because there are other people out there that are passionate and that you can find. I know that from experience. For a long time, I didn't think there were, and it did feel very isolating. But there absolutely are people out there, and it's just about, yeah, putting yourself maybe out of your comfort zone to go out and find them. And that's really, I think, where the energy and the passion comes from, is that sense of community.
Mm, yeah, exactly. Yeah, community like just draws you in. It's like a strange force. But practically speaking, the university will likely have a sustainability group. Friends of the Earth pretty much have a group in every county, and the kind of activism nature space is very well connected. So if you find one person, like I think how I got into Extinction Rebellion is just through a lady who just knew a ton of stuff, and she literally texted me, she's like, would you like to come to this event? And I did, and I just went to the next one. So you just got literally to get to an event and start talking to people, and then because you don't know what you don't know, basically. That will be a way. And you might end up doing more like, I end up doing photography for these people. You might end up like doing stuff within the university, but you'll find your way to whatever you're interested in. But you just have to go to the first event, which I'm sure you can like search on the uni website, hopefully.
If you talk to us afterwards, we can direct you to... there's events and stuff happening this year which we'll talk to you about.
Any other questions? Well, can I ask a question? It's about the Youth Council and the diversity of the communities it reaches. Is there a strategy, and how widely does it, in terms of ethnicity and class and urban versus rural? I mean, what kind of things are doing to encourage people from all kinds of backgrounds to get involved?
I think.
You go.
I think there's always something we're trying to do more on. I think it's there are kind of. Within the organization, we know that there is such a way to go. I think there was the race report, is a kind of annual report that shows that the environmental sector itself is like the second least diverse sector in the country after, I think, agriculture and farming. And so I think that we need to do so much more in terms of breaking outside of those echo chambers and actually, again, it's part of meeting people where they're at, I think, and that's something that we try to do a lot in terms of we're really looking at kind of what events can we go to and what new spaces can we kind of come to and talk to in order to reach outside of this kind of bubble and actually engage with people more meaningfully and kind of from taking into account their perspective, because I think it's something that is definitely lacking in the environmental sector, but it is so important because these are issues that affect every one of us and affect us really unequally as well. And so I think, yeah, there is so much more to do, but I think that's one of the things we try to do is reaching outside into new spaces.
I agree, and it's basically it's difficult, and like Freddie said, we have so much more to do. And I think sometimes it's not really there's a great organization called Flock Together, which is like bird watching conservation for people of color. And I think it's like being out in nature can be quite a risky thing for certain groups. And I think a recognition that there needed to be a specific space for these people, like there's a lot more female only bird watching groups like coming up and stuff like that. I think that that's also quite important, because I think sometimes organizations can be a bit like, oh, well, the diversity must just want to come to us. Why are they not here? Why is there no diversity? It's like, you know, sometimes you just need to those people themselves like need to be given the resources to create those spaces for themselves. But we're in terms of like we have representatives from all over the country, so we're definitely diverse in terms of that hours of train journey if you added it up to get to any one of our residentials is probably crazy. But yeah, definitely we need to do much more.
Ethnicity-wise, I mean, most of the RSPB in general is white.
Yeah, white middle class.
Yeah. We're not that diverse, which isn't good. And I'm not entirely sure if we have any policies, or we probably do, but I don't know about them. But there's, when we next do recruitment, there's something I did with a different organisation that I'm going to ask us to implement. It was if someone considered themselves to be part of a minority group, so to be, or to be part of an underrepresented group, so to either be a person of colour or queer or neurodivergent or anything like that, they automatically got an interview. And that's what I did with a different charity. So when we next recruit, I'm going to try and push that. And yeah.
Thank you. Well, our time has drawn to a close. But before we go, I'm sure you'd want to thank our panel this morning, afternoon, Freddie and Kay and Senan. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.